4.2 million Americans have now been canceled by their insurance companies.
Canceled your show.
And Futurama's been canceled.
Canceled.
Canceled too soon.
Is officially canceled.
We canceled twice. His launch pre-order bundle was canceled. Do we know it's a his?
Have been effectively canceled.
And abruptly canceled.
From Target is canceled.
Were unceremoniously canceled.
The plan was being canceled.
The cabal has been canceled.
Look at the role of the Rothschild family.
Money and power.
Monsanto and a few other chemical companies.
Culling the population through eugenics is their answer.
The World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and the World Trade Organization.
These are the most disgusting people on the face of this earth.
Or they control the information.
The powerful few people who run this planet,
they're not as powerful as you think.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Now brings you Castle the Cabal with Stephen Roberts. Stephen Roberts. Stephen Roberts.
Red or blue?
All right, and welcome, everyone. It's Wednesday evening here in America, early Thursday morning in Ireland, Scotland, the UK, and elsewhere. I'm Stephen Roberts, and this is People Internet's Radio's Cancel the Cabal. Welcome, everyone. Welcome, everyone all around the world. I have a very special guest with me tonight. I have a very outward opponent. I have Dr. Dalia Wasfi with me. Welcome to the show, Doctor.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I appreciate you coming on. You are you're the second war opponent that I've had on, as I mentioned to you during the little brief discussion before I was able to take the stream. I've had Max Egan on like two or three times now. He is a big opponent of the conflicts over in Israel and Gaza. And that's one subject that we will be touching upon. And as I mentioned to you just before we come on, Max Egan was on Sean McGuire's show. He was very outspoken, and he was not politically correct tonight. And as I mentioned to you, that's the main reason why he's only known on the internet. No one will allow him on any type of radio or television because of his words.
Well, I'm also very critical of the apartheid state of Israel. But I may not be as big a name as Max Egan, but I'm trying to get there. So we'll see what happens tonight.
Well, yes. I'd like to get a little bit of your background, just a quick bio from you. I could have read something, but I would rather hear it from you, Doctor. Dalia, I'm sorry.
Sure. The only problem is that sometimes I don't keep a short story short. I'll try to be as brief as I can. My father was born and raised in Basra, Iraq. He got his high school degree in Basra and then attended Baghdad University and graduated from Baghdad University in 1961, doing well enough to earn a government scholarship to do his graduate studies overseas. And he ended up coming to Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., where he met another first-year graduate student, who was my mom, and she was born and raised in New York. She was the daughter of Holocaust survivors who had fled their homeland of Austria during Hitler's Anschluss. And at the time that they met, my mom had been raised in a traditional Jewish home, which was a traditional Zionist home. And she'd only heard one narrative around the establishment of the State of Israel. But when she met my father and some of the other students who were living at the International Student House in Washington, D.C., she heard the other side of the story. And adding that narrative to her knowledge really changed her whole worldview. And my parents were married in 1968, had my sister in 1969, and then I was born in 1971. My father also earned his PhD in 71, and as part of the deal of his scholarship, he had to spend the same number of years back in Iraq teaching as he had spent in the U.S. doing his studies. So the first 5 years of my life were spent going back and forth between Iraq and the U.S., those were the early years that I spent there. But it was all, life was just blurred together for me, whether I was visiting my grandparents in New York or living during the school year in Iraq. I didn't really detect differences until I was older. We returned to the U.S. For the last time in 1977. My father was actually escaping, but that's a long story. It'll all be in the book. But we came back in 1977, always intending to go back and visit the family. But in 1980, the Iran-Iraq War started. That lasted until 1988. In 1990, on August 2nd, Iraqi troops moved into Kuwait. 6 months later, the first Gulf War was launched and then continued the economic sanctions for the next 13 years until the 2003 Shakana invasion. And during all that time, I had grown up, I'd gone to college and medical school and was doing residency training. But during the buildup to the Shakana invasion, I really had a huge crisis of conscience as to what I was doing with my life when I had in front of me the capacity to help with medical training and the most sophisticated medical equipment. Meanwhile, my government was already raining down bombs on Afghanistan and was preparing to attack Iraq again. And that, along with two other things going wrong with my life, I basically had a breakdown, and I had to really decide what I was going to do with my life from then on. And I followed the example of Rachel Corey, who was a 23-year-old college student who went to occupied Palestine and practiced civil disobedience to defend international law. She was killed by the Israeli military, and it struck me that she had gone thousands of miles and died protecting the home of people she otherwise had no connection with besides her humanity. And looking at what she did, I thought maybe I should go back and see my family, my relatives, whom I haven't seen in 27 years. So, see, I told you I couldn't make it short. So with her sort of as the inspiration for what to do next, I went to visit my family for 3 weeks in 2004 in Iraq, and I went back to Iraq again for 3 months in 2006. And as a result of my experiences, I wanted to use my American voice, my American privilege, to try to help those who had suffered for so long under dictatorship in Iraq and now were suffering under a brutal and illegal occupation. So that's how my activism started, and I've been very fortunate to have the opportunities I've had, and here I am speaking to you today.
Oh, that's great. You were born in America? Is that what you happened to mention?
I was born in New York, yes.
Born in New York, okay. Brooklyn, Bronx, Manhattan?
Manhattan. The hospital isn't there anymore. So, for at least a few minutes, I was a real New Yorker.
Yeah. Well, you still are a real New Yorker anyways.
I don't know. Heart. I was just there. I really can't handle the traffic.
Going back to 2002 and 2003, the Bush administration, they really tried to pull out all of these stops all of the rhetoric and all the manipulations in the American media, two things that come to mind to me were the so-called yellow cake that Saddam Hussein supposedly had. And, well, going back to 1990, it was the, I think it was the young woman that was the Kuwaiti ambassador's daughter or something like that, that told the world that Saddam Hussein was taking babies out of incubators and leaving them to lie on the ground and die. It seems apparent all over the world. You happen to mention a child in some sort of a distressing situation, and I don't know whether it just pulls at people's heartstrings or whether it's just a easy manipulation. What do you think, Adalia?
Oh, I think, well, actually, it was a public relations firm, Helen Knowlton, which had been consulted to put together that PR campaign.
Right.
And so I have, you know, this is calculated advertising, and I'm sure there were multiple specialists involved in determining what would garner support for military action, because the American people were still pretty hesitant. The legacy of Vietnam was still fresh with us, at relatively fresh at that point in time. The American people were not eager to send the U.S. military back into another theater, which is probably another public relations term. But that was a calculated PR move. Was Helen Knowlton was hired by the group called Citizens for a Free Kuwait, which is basically a front for the Kuwaiti government. And the testimony was given at a meeting of the Congressional Human Rights Caucus. And one of the coordinators, one of the leaders of that caucus, was Tom Lantos. I think I'm naming the right person, who had knowledge of what was going on behind the scenes. He had knowledge of who Naira, the young nurse, was, that she was the Kuwaiti ambassador's daughter. So it was very calculated. Then again, in the build-up to 2003, we heard all kinds of stories to garner, public support for the invasion of Iraq. And at that point, people were really like, wait a minute, we're not sure that you're telling us the truth here. And we came up with that Iraq had ties to Al-Qaeda, Iraq was responsible for what happened on September 11th, 2001, Iraq has nuclear weapons, Iraq has WMDs, we have to go save the people of Iraq, which, quite frankly, was not an impressive call for Iraqis themselves, having just experienced the 12 to 13 years of economic sanctions and the starvation and suffering that had brought. It wasn't a convincing argument to them. But again, this searching for public appeal to garner support for military action. And we see it again today. We hear about terrorists, ISIS terrorists taking over Iraq and Syria, when this is not the reality that's happening on the ground. In Iraq, there is a popular uprising. ISIS, which now goes by IS, just Islamic State, they are now, they have declared caliphate, but the largest group of Sunni religious leaders in Iraq has said, no, you can't do that. First of all, you haven't consulted the people of Iraq and Syria to see if they want that. And second, this is perceived as an attempt to divide Iraq, and this is not the time for this. So that was at least politically put them in check. But what's happening is, as a result of the invasion and illegal occupation of Iraq since 2003, and the installation of a government came to power under the occupation and is rejected by the majority of the people, you have now a popular uprising that's taking place. But again, as we have shipped arms to Nouri al-Maliki's regime in Iraq, and we're backing still officially backing that regime, although we stated that he should step down. What we are trying to do is maintain our control in the region and make sure that that is constant. That's what we are really concerned about. So whatever it will take to garner support from the American people, that's what we will hear on the mainstream media, because the corporations who own the mainstream media are the corporations who have ties to the government. So it's a nice little dog and pony show. The problem is that millions of people are suffering, and literally over a million people are dead because of U.S. foreign policy. And that's just since 2003. There's many more millions before that. But this is a calculated effort. And if we knew the truth, then we would not go along with these policies that are bringing harm to people. They have to tell us a good story.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, it is. And the truth of the story is, Dahlia, that U.S. government and British and Saudi Arabian has been financing some of these militant groups. They've been financing Al-Qaeda for over 30 years now. What a lot of people don't realize is the American CIA and the American State Department funded and started Al-Qaeda back in the late 70s. You try to tell somebody that, and they look at you like you have three eyes on your forehead.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. And of course, Osama bin Laden was a CIA operative, because at that time, he served our agenda. His interests, I think both the U.S. government and bin Laden were coming at the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan from different positions, but both of them wanted the invasion repelled, so they collaborated. Today, what we're seeing is that we have, since it came to power, the government of Nouri al-Maliki has been backed by the United States since it came to power under the U.S.-led occupation. And so we've got that side back. We're also arming and backing some of these, as you said, extremist militant groups because of their role as rebels in Syria. And I think we will continue to play both sides until we identify what's going to settle out, what's going to happen when the dust settles, and then, again, to maintain our influence in the region, what's best for us. The well-being, the welfare of the people who live there, their self-determination, their democracy, that is not a priority for us. So whenever you hear the word from U.S. government officials that we're promoting democracy, take another look, because it's probably not true.
No, I don't hardly believe anything that the American government says, Dahlia. Not for the last 5 years anyways. I was one.
Oh, you can take it back further than that.
Yeah, but, this is all I can attest to from, being a researcher and a, someone who's aware of things now. But previous to 5 years ago, I did believe all the rhetoric and the, deceptions.
Well, there's hope in that, because most people, I think, don't have time, especially with the state of the economy today. People are working multiple jobs. They're trying to put food on the table. They don't have that much time with their families. So when they get home from work, they spend what little time they have with each other. And then next day, they got to start all over again. There isn't really much of an opportunity for people to go and dig for any different perspective on the information other than what's coming out of the television set. But the fact that you were in a place where you believed what they were telling you and you broke out of it and you're now hosting your own show, I mean, that's a success story right there. I don't know what I would be doing if I didn't have the background that I did, if I didn't have that that insider's view that my background has given me, because I've grown up with it, learning about Palestine since I was little. The occupation started before my life started, and you know, I had the other information, but the mainstream media, of course, this is why they call it programming. The mainstream media has a certain line that they feed us. And even on, something that is so protective as the characterization of the Israeli government, the Israeli army, that's even falling apart now. And the truth is coming to light. Unfortunately, hundreds of people, have to die, for that to happen. But hopefully we get to the point where there is no more killing, there is no more occupation. And basically ending the occupation is the critical step that needs to take place, for, conflict in that part of the world to end. That and basically respecting everyone's humanity and giving, each person a vote. That's democracy. That's real self-determination. But that's not what we want. We talk about that a lot, and our government talks about that a lot, but, truthfully speaking, we care more about the American dollar than we do about people's lives. And that's the real tragedy.
Yes, yes, it absolutely is. The American corporation, well, it's not just the American corporation, but it's just the Western corporation, British, French, American, whatever the Western party might be, they seem to take more of a back seat to the small people, or the little people, as we're called, and the corporation seems to get the front seat, and they get all the flashy perks. I would never try to bring up Saddam Hussein as being a good guy or anything, but there is an argument out there. Maybe you can attest to, or maybe you can comment on the argument was that sure, Saddam Hussein was a bad guy, but he did keep peace in the region.
This is,
between the Sunni.
I guess how I would phrase it, which is not much different from what you said, but basically there's no question about the ruthlessness of his rule. He came to power violently. He maintained his power violently.
Also by the CIA.
Yes, absolutely. From at least 1959
yes.
Onward. And sort of the ridiculous part of that is that, after the British were kicked out of Iraq in 1958, the two main groups that were battling for power to fill the void were the socialists, the Ba'athists, or the communists. And the United States had just come out of the really strong years of McCarthyism. I could say we're still coming out of the strong years of McCarthyism. And, did not want to see all the oil in Iraq go under communist control. We feared the communists. And so they thought, the Ba'athists and Saddam Hussein in particular was a good alternative. So there's no issue about, the political repression that went on under Saddam Hussein. Never mind that it's still going on today. But the other side of what the Ba'athist rule did was that it invested, well, first it nationalized Iraq's oil so that, instead of profits from the sale of Iraqi oil going to Exxon and Mobil, which were two separate companies at that time, or British Petroleum, they went into the, Iraqi state. And while certainly the, top members of the Ba'ath Party, Ba'athists, benefited greatly from that. They also invested millions into the infrastructure of Iraq. And by the late 70s, Iraq's economy had exploded, had a top-ranked medical system, had an excellent educational system. Even the infrastructure in terms of agriculture and machinery, industrialization, everything had improved. So that actually in the late 70s, the Iraqi dinar was worth $3.44. And the dollar wasn't doing half bad at that point. So that was an incredible economic boom for Iraq. So on that side, there were benefits. And I think the politically, Iraq, and my father would say this all the time, Iraq is a very difficult country to rule. And he led it with an iron fist, and held the country together. Now, I'm not so sure that Iraq is going to fall apart, without Saddam Hussein there. But because we are the West, in particular the United States, is seeking to enhance the division within Iraqi society. It has worked since 2003 to divide Iraq. So, but whatever it is, whatever happens to Iraq, that should be and must be up to Iraqi people. This is the cradle of civilization. Iraqis today are the descendants of the people who invented the first system of writing, the basics of law, science, and medicine. I feel confident that left to themselves without external oppression, they will create their own future and be fine with it. Really, the problem at this point in time is external interference, and that includes though most U.S. troops are gone. There's a huge embassy that's still there in Iraq, the U.S. embassy, which is really CIA headquarters. And now we've sent more special forces in, and we've sent more arms in, and that has to stop. We need to stop funding the brutal regime that's there in Iraq now, just as we should have stopped funding Saddam Hussein's regime when he was committing his crimes.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Dahlia, can you speak a little bit on the Kurds to the north? Are they actually Iraqi, or are they some other people?
Well, they are. So the Kurdish people is an ethnicity, and the Kurds are the second largest ethnicity group in Iraq. The first is Arabs, and Arabs are about 80%. And the Kurds are around 15 to 20%. But what happened when the British carved up the region was that the Kurdish population got divided up as well. So there are Kurds in Turkey, Kurds in Iraq, Kurds in Iran, and Kurds in Syria. So they're all the same ethnic group. Some of them, depending on where the border was drawn, the same family or same tribal history, but they got divided. So there has always been, this wasn't sort of another means of the Western imperial powers maintaining control in the region, was to push groups of people together that otherwise would not have governed within the same governance. So Iraq was put together as three separate, they were three separate provinces, under the Ottoman Empire. Basra province in the south, Baghdad province, just above Basra, and then Mosul province in the north. And those three provinces were put together, kind of patchworked together to make the country of Iraq. While there are many Kurds with aspirations for independence and their own country, there are also Kurds whose national identity is Iraq first. And that actually, that's amongst many Arab Iraqis as well. Their identity of being Iraqi comes first ahead of whatever religion differentiation that takes place. But with the Kurdish population divided in four different countries, this allows each of those countries to also kind of keep in check one another. And to give an example, the Turkish government historically has not wanted Iraqi Kurds to have independence because they wouldn't want Turkish Kurds to start rebelling and demanding independence from the Turkish government. So it gets very, very complicated. And again, it should be up to the people of the region determining their own future. Definitely not the business of the U.S. government and or anybody else. But my priority as an American is to speak out against, both usually against the policies of my government, but I have to raise my voice and say, hey, leave those people alone. We got plenty of problems here at home to take care of, and we need the money that you're spending on armaments to rebuild our infrastructure, for just an example. So so that's how the Kurds in Iraq came to be the Iraqi Kurds.
Yes. Well, I thought maybe I heard somewhere that wasn't there a large Kurd population over in Russia too, just across the Russian border?
You know, if that's historically, then I'm unfamiliar with that. I'm sorry about that.
No, that's okay. That's okay.
Please excuse my ignorance.
That's okay.
Especially for your audience, if they're pulling their hair out right now. But that, my knowledge is really limited to really more recent times than just the region of Western Asia.
Yeah. Well, I guess we can take this last little bit here. I wasn't going to take a break or anything for your 1 hour, but I thought maybe we could talk about Gaza and Israel.
Sure.
That's been a tumultuous subject and a subject of turmoil, depending on which side of the political party you happen to subscribe to, which I don't subscribe to any party anymore. So, but Israel and Gaza, I believe in the last 60 plus some odd years, Israel has taken, I think, over 95% of that area and claimed it as their own.
It's high. I'm not sure if it's 95%, but it's, that number is increasing all the time. And that's one of the problems, is that, the state of Israel has no defined border. And it continues as this operation, sort of protective edge, there's a lot of, excuses used for why the Israelis are committing a massacre in Gaza. But the underlying goal, which has been the goal for Zionism since the plan was made to establish a Jewish state in Palestine, was to take the whole land of that area, as well as portions of Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan, and Egypt too, I think. This is from as early as 1919. So the goal here is really ethnic cleansing, as it has been since 1948. So that's at the root of the problem. The root of the American problem is that we have been taught to stay silent on Israel's crimes and Israel's governmental policies, and the threat that is put out to us is that, well, if you criticize Israel, then you're anti-Semitic. And that is simply a falsehood. But it's very easy, especially with the legacy of World War II, it's very easy to silence people with that threat. And it's probably a lot easier for me to be comfortable in talking about it, because on my mother's side, my grandparents were Holocaust survivors. But it's in their name that we say never again. And on behalf of both sides of my family, I'm trying to do my part to bring an end to illegal occupation. Areas of Israel have been under occupation since 1948. The indigenous people have been kicked out. And then the West Bank, the Gaza, and the Golan Heights of Syria have been under Israeli military occupation since 1967. And international law has declared that the Israelis must withdraw from these occupied territories, but no one has bothered to enforce those resolutions from the United Nations. So that's the root of the problem. It's not two even sides in a war, which is often how the American mainstream media projects it. It is occupier and occupied. And you're talking about one of the most sophisticated weapons arsenals in the world, in Israel, which includes between 200 and 400 nuclear weapons, versus a people that are virtually defenseless, have maybe a few rockets that can reach Tel Aviv, but mostly it's homemade rockets that don't do anywhere near as much damage as a missile from an F-15 or F-16 fighter plane. So this is a defenseless people that are trapped on a tiny area of land, and the majority of the population, the majority of the population are women and children, and half the population are under 18. So these are war crimes. There's no other way around that. These are war crimes being committed by the Israelis, and with American collaboration, because it is only with $3.1 billion of military support, as well as political support in the governmental arena, that Israel can continue this naked aggression against a mostly defenseless people. And there are more and more demonstrations around the world, and more people becoming active around this issue because this is why I do activism too, is because my government is putting blood on my hands. And I have the right to say my government is not allowed to do this in my name. So that's why I do it. And more people around the world, as each successive massacre, takes place, by the Israelis against Palestinians, it's more obvious if more people become aware, and hopefully there will be an end to the occupation, which is the critical problem. That's the solution, is ending the occupation. Until that step happens, there is no chance for peace.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Well, Dalia, maybe you know this, but millions of people don't. The Israeli government and the Mossad actually funded and started Hamas.
That's right.
Yes, and this is documented in two Israeli newspapers over there, and I'm not even so sure that there may be some televised documentation of this. But and you also happen to if somebody happens to hear this from you, they also look at you like you have a third eye on
right.
your face, and it doesn't really occurred to people, and it doesn't really resonate with them because of the American media's deceptions and the American government's deceptions. People seem to have this nationalism all over the world, and it's very, very prevalent here in America. You really almost have to subscribe to one of the two political parties. That's all the choices we have. I mean, there seems to be like a dozen parties out there: the Tea Party, the Green Party, the Liberty Party, and people really need to band together. What do you think a solution is to try to reach people?
Of course, it's the solution that I ascribe to, is education. That's basically what I've tried to do, even if it's just to put a human face on the so-called enemy whom we're attacking. We have, as you mentioned, from the messages in the media and the particular narrative in the media, usually when we see Arabs in general or Muslims in general portrayed on television, we often see young men. They're often marching together. They're often wearing black.
Or they're violent.
They're very violent. Sometimes they're carrying weapons. They're chanting in a language we don't understand. They often have their faces covered for their own protection. But this puts more of a distance between us and them. We see these images that register in our heads, but we don't know why they're angry. We don't know why they're armed. And we don't see the majority of the population who are women and children. And we don't see the policies that the United States has that severely affects the morbidity and mortality of those people living over there, those others over there. So even just putting a human face on who these people are, that dehumanization is a critical element, not just for the American population to continue to buy into U.S. policies, but more specifically, it's used to train soldiers. You can't take the life of another human as easily if you consider their life as of equal value to your own. So there's a whole process of dehumanization that goes on. I mentioned earlier the divide and conquer that empires do overseas, but I think this whole Democrat versus Republican is another tactic of divide and conquer. There really isn't all that much difference between the two parties. Where there is difference are not critical issues that affect the nation. We're focused on non-issues.
Right. The petty little issues that's what they fight about in front of the cameras, but the big infrastructure, the big corporate picture is what is really looked at by both sides, and that agenda is brought forth.
They share it. It's the same
yes,
agenda.
Yes, they do. Yes, they
so
do.
So they put forth the idea that they're on opposing sides.
Yes.
And there's no way, as you said, like how could 300 million people find their views represented by one of two parties? It just, you know, the math doesn't make sense.
Well, it's just an illusion that there is one of two parties. Right. It's
exactly.
One party. Yes.
Exactly.
And that's what people don't really realize. There's a lot of, I don't want to say, Israeli haters in the world, but, you know, it's not so much Israeli haters. It's the government. I don't hate my government. I just, our government was hijacked by criminals long, long ago. So it's really a false argument when somebody says that you hate your government, because
yeah, I have extreme dislike for my government.
Well, certainly, yes.
But just to follow up on the point you're making, like to criticize policies is to do just that. So, for example, to criticize apartheid South Africa was not to be anti-Dutch; it was to oppose the racist policies of that system. To criticize the policies of the Third Reich is not anti-German. It was to be against the racist genocidal policies of that system. To criticize United States foreign policy is not anti-American. It's to condemn war crimes. And to criticize the apartheid state of Israel is not anti-Semitic. It's righteously condemning a racist genocidal system. And that, once you get to that point where it's not a question where we're not pointing fingers of racism, saying that, oh, well, if you criticize Israel, that's anti-Semitic. That's false. Again, that's thrown out there to end discussions. But the problem is that in the U.S., the political movement of Zionism, which is the movement to establish the Jewish homeland, has been so closely intertwined with Judaism that it has tainted it, because Zionism is a nationalistic, racist philosophy. Judaism is not, but the Zionists blurred their movement with Judaism, what the Israelis are doing today with their massacres of innocent people in Gaza, it's backfiring. Because if Zionism is so tightly connected to Judaism, that's been developed in the U.S., then the backlash is going to be increased in anti-Semitism. I should say anti-Jewish anti-Semitism, because Arabs are also Semites. So that is a terrible consequence of what Zionism has done and is doing. The criticism of Israeli policy towards the Palestinians is not anti-Semitic. Actually, Israeli policy against Palestinian Arabs is anti-Semitic. So now I'm getting into an issue of semantics, but that's a critical clarification to make. And again, it's easier for me to talk about this because of what my grandparents experienced, because of the background that I have. But let me, I hope that I can make other people better understand what the situation is. And then the more information that you get, the more comfortable you are in making the argument. Because I think all we want is justice. All we want is any of us around the world. We want to just live our lives and raise our families and have a decent standard of living. This is just what people want. So if there's an area of conflict, there's a point of injustice that is unresolved. And that's what we have to look towards. And that's why I used to end my speeches with no justice, no peace. Because that's just the bottom line. Until there is justice, until justice is served, there will be no peaceful resolution.
That's one of the questions I was going to ask you of, Dahlia. There's a very, very famous video out there, where somebody has taken a speech of yours. I'm not sure if that was at the UN or whether it was somewhere else. And they made a collage of, images and put it to about, I think, 4.5 to 5 minutes of your speech. And, the very, very last ending of it, they took and made an echo out of your No Justice, No Peace. I thought maybe you might talk about your past activism. I mean, what you plan on doing in the future and what you've done in the past.
Sure. And I thank you for bringing that up, because I want to give credit to YouTube user The Paradigm Shift, who put that compilation.
Is that who that was? Okay.
Yeah. That actually, I think so many of my opportunities and so much of my exposure has been by way of his talent and his work to make that compilation. So credit to him for that. YouTube user is a paradigm shift. I'm very honored that you thought I would be speaking at the UN, but no, that invitation hasn't come through yet. I started my talks in 2004 after my first trip to Iraq, and I didn't know what I was doing. All I was doing was following my heart and just wanting to put a human face on Iraqis. And so literally I just had pictures from my trip to Iraq, and I just started showing them to, I was living in Denver, Colorado at the time, and I connected with some peace groups out there, and I started to show just family pictures, basically. And then people started asking more questions, so I started doing more research, and my talk evolved from there. Then after my second visit to Iraq in 2006, 1 month to the day that I got back, on April 27th, 2006, I got to speak at a congressional forum, and that speech, that was my first speech that made it onto the internet, and that also gave me a lot more exposure, and I began to get invitations to speak around the country. And again, I've had incredible opportunities. Fortunately, I have benefited a great deal from what I do. It's been therapeutic to be able to inform people of what's happening to the people on the ground there. But unfortunately, it hasn't changed anything on the ground. Things have actually only gotten worse in the time that I've been doing this. But in spite of that, I mean, I get some of the best feedback I get is from people who tell me that they saw my speech and it made them think about things differently, or it made them gave them a little bit more confidence to speak out in their own lives. That's actually that's one of my top rewards. The other is when I hear from an Iraqi, because so much of what I do is connected to my father, who was from Iraq. He passed away in 2012. Part of my trip to Iraq in 2004 and 2006 was to give him a connection to the family, because he wasn't well and he wasn't able to go back to Iraq. The last time he saw his family was in 1977. So I wanted to be sort of the vehicle through which we could connect with them, and my dad could connect with them, and they could connect with him. So a lot of it, my father is wrapped up in it. And so if I hear from an Iraqi that they've seen my work and they appreciate what I've done, I mean, that's really the top reward I get, because what my government does has brought Iraqis so much harm and so much suffering. So it's really, and that, you know, bottom line is when you help somebody, it gives you a great reward. It doesn't have to be on an international scale, even just person to person, even the smallest little effort. And I think when more of us know the truth and start to do that and get rid of the fear that's been given to us, that's been imposed on us through the media to purposely keep us quiet, as more and more people raise their voices, I hope and pray that we will reach a tipping point of voices that says this is enough, and this is not what we want. This is not what those people deserve, and we are the ones that have to make up for what's been done in our name. And it may be tilting at windmills. That's okay. I still remain optimistic. Again, because of a story like yours, of somebody who was on one side and then completely changed how they perceive the world. This is happening out there every day. And for the sake of the people who have no voice or whose voices have been taken from them, I think that's our obligation to be in a position where we have our voices, for us to raise them. We'll all be better off if we do that.
Yes, I think we will also, Dahlia. I mentioned it was just over 5 years ago when I started my activism. And that is right at the time that I started, I went back to college. So I'm clearly under the impression that college, makes a person one of two things, either an anarchist or a socialist. And it clearly turned me into an anarchist.
Good for you.
Yeah, good for me.
But that's even, you know, and I think that the thing, that's exactly why fewer and fewer people have access to education in this country. It's increasingly a privilege for the wealthy rather than something that's available to everyone. And if we really want national security, if we really want a strong country, we will educate the next generation and the current generation and anybody who wants an education. So, you know, that's not easy to go back to school. So much respect for that and for keeping an open mind. And that's like I said, there is hope in that. And I'm not saying that I know it all and I don't have anything to learn. I I learn every day how much I don't know. So I learn from people who interact with me, who are kind enough to send me articles. I'm learning every day. And again, that's why I think I've benefited so much from the work I do. But I think that's a great, and whether your education comes from a college or comes from the internet, just expanding your horizons and keeping an open mind. Here's living proof in Stephen that, you know, it makes difference and it can make a world of change.
Yes, it does. You happen to mention when you were a young girl, you were brought up in a pro-Israel Zionist type.
My mom was.
Mother was. Okay. Well, I was going to ask you maybe a bit of a tough question, but did you ever have problems talking to your parents about your anarchy ways, or?
Only because I've never thought about it, and because I don't want to be pigeonholed because of the work I do, I don't identify with any ism. I think there's a lot of ideologies out there that have very good principles and tenets, but I steer away from that kind of political identification because I don't want to be put into a certain box, if you will. I could tell you that, my parents, both my parents, with an Arab father and a Jewish mother, medical school fulfills all their dreams. It shouldn't surprise you that I have an older sister who's also got her medical degree. She's still working in medicine. I don't work in medicine anymore. But to leave behind the financial security, that was the big thing of that career, and stability.
Are you there? I think I'm losing you a little bit. Are you there, Dahlia? Okay. Got a bit of a problem there. I'll see about getting her back here quick. I lost her there let's see if I can get her back. Just about at the end, too. So, okay. I'm going to put a quick song on here and see what happens. See if I can wrap this up here in a few minutes, everyone. See about getting her back for just a quick minute or so. All right, we're back, everyone. I got her back. I think her Skype started to freeze on me, and then she was gone. We were talking about
another quarter in.
Yeah, had to put. Well, now with inflation, it's probably $3.50.
Yeah, exactly.
But
so how far do we get? I was just talking.
Yeah,
what? Well, danger.
You were getting into. You didn't really get into your parents with the politics. I think that's what you were trying to get to.
I was on this track for a career in medicine, and but my heart was always looking back. Now I can see over the years where my real passion was. Leaving that materialistic life behind for me was optional. That was something I had to do for myself. For my parents to come around with me doing this crazy activist life, that I think it's almost set in for my mom. But my parents have been extremely supportive, and it's actually because of them, either by taking care of my dog or by helping me financially, that I'm able to do my activism, and I'm able to work on a book these days rather than having to work full time. So both my parents came around to what I was doing and ended up being my biggest supporters. So I'm very, very fortunate for that.
Well, that's wonderful. I think I'll make this the last question, Dahlia. I don't want to keep you any longer than what you need to be. But, well, we touched upon the solution for Iraq, but let's touch upon a solution for Gaza.
Well, the international community needs to call for an immediate ceasefire to stop the massacre that the Israelis are currently conducting against Gaza. They have been threatening a ground invasion for about a week now, and there will be great loss of life on both sides if they proceed with that. This is naked aggression, and the international community, in defense of international humanitarian law, should rein Israel in. Israel is a rogue state at this point that is not abiding by international law. In the long term, the United States needs to cut its military aid to Israel, which would then be in compliance with the U.S. Arms Export Act, which states that we do not deal arms to countries that use those arms for purposes other than self-defense. And this is naked aggression, but the Israelis are using this weaponry, whether it's historically the invasions of Lebanon, the bombing of Syria, the historically the invasions of Egypt, and the ongoing occupations of the Golan Heights, West Bank, and Gaza.
And Libya and Syria. And Libya and Syria.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to mention, Dahlia, that it was not a coincidence and it was not an accident that, Skype was cut on us, because I'd been seeing little flashes. My little virus protection had been going off through the whole show.
Really?
Yes. And they were attacking both of us. They were attacking Skype, and I believe they probably, shut Skype down until I could get you back there for, you know, for a minute or so, but,
well, I'm very proud of that.
Yeah.
I'm proud too.
I am too. And it is not the first time it's ever happened to me. It's happened, a dozen times or so. I've been cut off in midstream, and
that means you're doing good work.
That's right. It does.
I want to thank you again for the opportunity to speak with you tonight and to share my story with you and your audience.
And I appreciate you coming on. I really do.
Anytime. And, for sure, when I finish my book, I will be screaming from the rooftop. So, I'll look forward. I hope I get the chance to speak with you again when that's done.
All right. Thank you, Dahlia.
Thank you so much. Have a good night.
Good night. All right, everyone. Dr. Dahlia Wasfi. Thanks everyone for coming on. I don't really have a whole much planned, for now on. I'm just going to, I've got to work on some things. I was going to do a little bit of talking, but I don't know. I'll see what goes on here. So I'm going to put that song back on and start it back up and see what goes on from there, everyone. So good night, everyone. I'm Stephen Roberts. This has been People's Internet Radio's Cancel the Cabal.